welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, September 25th, 2020. Parties today revitalize 2018 peace agreement, sign another power-sharing agreement.
All these delays we brought us up to today were the IO, and we will not be ready to continue to let our people continue to suffer because the IO is objective.
And leaders from Central Equatoria react to a ministerial order.
We were surprised to have a letter from the office of the Honorable Minister Peter Mayen, the Minister of Humanitarian Affairs and Disaster Management, which declared Mangala as a displaced persons camp.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Some parties that signed the South Sudan's revitalized peace agreement inked another agreement on power sharing today to facilitate the formation of state and county governments. The SPLM-IO, loyal to Riek Machar, did not sign today's agreement, saying they need time to consult with their party members. Each of the 10 states will have 17 ministers, 7 commissions and 71 members of parliament. For VOA News, Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
According to the power-sharing agreement seen by South Sudan in Focus, each state will have 17 ministries, 7 commissions and 71 members of parliament. Officials say the parties agreed on how to share power and responsibilities in 68 of 79 counties across the 10 states plus the 2 administrative areas of Pibor and Rueng. The parties have yet to agree on how to share power in the 11 remaining counties. Since dissolving the country's national and state governments in February, President Salva Kiir appointed governors but no other state government structures or officials. The new agreement enables the parties to move forward and nominate county commissioners, ministers for state governments, and reconstitute state assemblies. A committee made up of representatives from the parties that signed the peace agreement has been negotiating for months on the power-sharing deal. Interior Minister Paul Mayom Akech represents President Salva Kiir's faction in the committee negotiating the allocation of portfolios for states and counties.
It is my hope and the hope of my colleagues here that the parts that have been completed, that are undisputed, be taken over by the parties, implement them, and have our people receiving their services through these institutions that are vital for their services.
Under the power-sharing deal, South Sudan will have 710 lawmakers in the 10 states' legislative assemblies, 170 ministers in state governments, and 17 chairpersons of commissions in all 10 states, along with 10 governors and 10 deputy governors. Wilson Lodiong represents other political parties, an umbrella group of parties that was a signatory to the peace agreement on the committee that negotiated the power-sharing deal.
Today we have reached a conclusion that things must go the way we want it. Let the South Sudanese begin to rejoice. In a few days, the government in the states and the local governments will be formed and we shall continue to move forward.
Chang Son Chiang represented the South Sudan Opposition Alliance on the committee.
We concluded the task successfully. In most of the cases, we have completed the allocation and determination of portfolios in these states.
South Sudan Information Minister Michael McQuay, representing Kiir's faction in the committee, blames the delay to resolve the issue of power sharing in the states and counties on the SPLM-IO.
All these delays we brought us up to today were the IO, and we will not be ready to continue to let our people continue to suffer because the IO is objective, or because the IO has its own plans that it must achieve before we could bring peace to South Sudan.
South Sudan in Focus was unable to reach SPLM-IO officials regarding their decision not to sign the latest power-sharing deal. SPLMI or Deputy Chairperson Henry Oduor did not answer repeated calls, while SPLMI or spokesperson Peter Manawa's phone was unreachable. Makwe says the parties have yet to agree on how to reconstitute South Sudan's lower chamber of parliament, which is expected to host 550 lawmakers.
For the National Legislative Assembly, we have not yet touched it, and because there are things, constitutional issues which are still not yet clear. There is confusion happening between the National Constitutional Amendment Committee and CAC and the Ministry of Justice.
In addition, the parties have yet to reconstitute the upper chamber of South Sudan's parliament, known as the Council of States, which is expected to host at least 20 lawmakers. Committee members say they have referred unresolved issues to their party principals, President Kiir, First Vice President Riek Machar, and the heads of the other parties to the peace deal. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
The United Nations Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in South Sudan is appealing for more than $80 million to respond to the needs of families affected by floods in South Sudan. The acting head of OCHA in South Sudan says out of the $80 million, $46 million is required to provide immediate assistance for nearly 400,000 people until the end of the year. For VOA News, Viola Elias reports from Juba.
Esteban Sako, acting head of UN OCHA, who visited flood-affected areas including Jungle State, Duke County, and Unity State's Panijar County, calls the situation depressing. Sako says humanitarian workers on the ground are providing food, temporary shelters, fishing kits, water purification tablets, and medicine to flood victims. Sako says more resources are needed for the overall flood response, including millions of dollars to provide immediate assistance to thousands of people affected.
There are more people that have been affected, so probably we need to increase that. But that means money, so that is what we are asking for, resources. The same is some of the items that I'm mentioning before. So we are at the end of the year, so most of our warehouses are pretty much empty.
Sako says the agencies will prioritize providing relief food as an emergency response to people who have lost their farms, their animals, and their homes.
We have two type of people that have been affected by the floods. Those who essentially still have a house, or they still live in a dry piece of land, but probably they lost their farming areas. So essentially they don't have food to provide to themselves because the crops has been destroyed by the floods, or the animals have died, you know. So that is one group of people that have been affected. But there is another group of people that have been affected that also have lost their farms or their animals, but in addition to that, they have lost their homes.
Sako says that second group are their priority because the heavy rains are expected to continue for the next 3 months. 31-year-old Mabankur of Jungule's Bor County says flood victims like him have suffered for 3 months. He is urging humanitarian agencies to provide food now.
One of the major priorities that need to be addressed, if any international organization or local organization or the government is listening, they should actually provide food to the needy people. Second things, sleeping bag and also the net and some blanket.
Kur also appealed to humanitarian organizations to drill boreholes to provide clean drinking water for those who fled to Mangala County. Jungle State flood victims Yom Gui says there is an urgent need for humanitarian assistance. Gui says the flooding has destroyed crops and homes in many communities. She is calling on aid agencies to provide plastic sheets and emergency kit to protect people from contracting diseases.
Since the water was coming rapidly, most of the property was washed away with the water, and most of the houses are now being destroyed because they were just clay made. So I suggest if there's any help that is given to us, then it should be plastic sheets that we can use to cover the roofs of the houses that we are making, and then the buckets and some soap to keep the hygiene.
UN OCHA says $46 million out of the $80 million appeal will be used to provide immediate assistance for nearly 400,000 people through the end of the year. Since July, more than 600,000 people have been affected by floods in Jungule, Lake Unity, Upper Nile, Central and Western Equatorial States, according to the UN. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias in Juba.
Officials from Central Equatorial State are criticizing a decision by the National Minister of Humanitarian Affairs to declare Mangala Village a new location to host families displaced by floods in Jungle State. The Acting Secretary General for Central Equatorial State says the minister should have waited for a report from a committee tasked with surveying the area. For VOA News, Onen Walter Solomon reports from Juba.
In a September 23rd letter seen by South Sudan in Focus that was sent to county authorities, NGOs, UN agencies and South Sudan Relief and Rehabilitation Commission, Majongdit wrote, due to natural calamities and disaster caused by the flooding effects that have resulted in the displacement of persons, the government, through the Ministry of Humanitarian Affairs, decided to establish an internally displaced persons camp in Mangala town. The decision prompted the Central Equatorial Secretary General, Francis Luala, to call a news conference yesterday to clarify on the matter, which it already sparked outrage on social media. Luala is chairperson of the committee Central Equatorial Governor Emmanuel Adil Anthony formed to identify land on which flood victims could settle.
We were surprised to have a letter from the office of the Honorable Minister Peter Mayen, the Minister of Humanitarian Affairs and Disaster Management, which declared Mangala as a displaced persons camp. The role of our committee was to actually first go and meet with the chiefs at the ground, being aware that the land belongs to the community, to identify a piece of land, not the whole area of Mangala town.
Luala says the committee met with local chiefs who identified a certain piece of land for the flood victims. He says a final decision on that land, located south of Mangala town, has yet to be taken because a team of engineers must first determine the dimensions of the area before it is declared an IDP camp.
This area that had been identified will only be used for these camp settlements. No permanent structures will be built on it. No permanent structures will be built on it. And according to the order of the governor, it's going to be temporary for 3 months. With the belief that up to November or December, the rain season will be over, bore will be appropriate for the return of our brothers and sisters who have been displaced by the flood.
Moses Potia, an activist from Terekeka County, where Mangala is located, says the Mondari and Bari communities are in dispute over who owns Mangala. He says declaring the area an IDP camp is likely to escalate that dispute.
If you go through the social media, you find such ideas. So it's like the two sides will then question if there is a plan to grab Mangala. You see that? It will not be looked at an angle of hosting people who are affected by flood. Because when the Mondari alleged to have attacked Mangala, that was 2 months ago, we discredited the situation by meeting the local authorities by pushing them to have a political solution, which has not happened. And that is already a pending issue.
Luala says even people who come from Jongle but reside in Juba and not affected by the floods are moving to Mangala. He says flood victims who have cattle should continue to graze their animals in flood-free areas in the southern part of Jongle State to avoid conflict with local farmers.
If there is anything to do with the accommodation of the cattle, that may be something beyond my capacity. Cattle in South Sudan are exactly the question of the armed. Our civilians are carrying arms, illegal arms, causing almost threat all over. Even for us in Central Equatoria, we have our brothers here from Tarkaka. They also have cattle.
Luala says a preliminary assessment indicates the number of IDPs stands at 19,800. Traditional chiefs who are among the IDPs said the number could be closer to 80,000, according to Luala. Derek Dirickson, a press secretary in the office of the Central Equatorial State Governor, says Governor Emmanuel Adil Anthony and Minister Mayen met this morning and they understood the issues but did not elaborate. Minister Mayen says he will speak to South Sudan in Focus on Saturday. For VOA News, I am Onan Walter Solomon in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the International Monetary Fund advises Sudan. That story is coming up right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
if you could relive an age, what age would you like to be?
I would like to go back to my secondary school days because there are other things that I see that I did not do well. I was very childish.
I would say that the age between 20 and 22nd. By that time, I think I was very more handsome than today, and I was energetic than today.
That's 18, because it's the time I enjoyed most. I got to know more about life, what the world is all about.
I would like to be at the age of 17, because at that time, we go out. We go out for hunting, playing football, or a lot of entertaining activities.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. A senior advisor at Sudan's Ministry of Finance and Economic Planning says his country has embarked on a program of economic reform with the International Monetary Fund. The program is aimed at stabilizing the country's economy. For VOA News, Nabil Biagio reports from Washington.
The IMF said in a Wednesday statement that the 12-month staff monitored program will support Sudan's homegrown program of reforms aimed at stabilizing the economy, improving competitiveness, and strengthening governance. Mehdi Amin is a senior advisor at Sudan's Minister of Finance.
This program, negotiated with the IMF a while ago, was then reviewed by the board and was deemed to be of a very high quality, called upper credit tranche quality. That standard of quality means that, assuming that we implement this for a minimum of 6 months, we can move into the process for highly indebted poor countries called HIPC. And by going into HIPC, it will be leading to a process of clearing our arrears.
Sudan's external debt stands at $56 billion, 85% of which is owed in arrears. Amin says Sudan also has foreign debts to the IMF, the World Bank, and the African Development Bank, which prevent it from accessing resources such as loans and grants from those institutions.
So by going into HIPC and clearing the arrears, we would also gain access to those sources of official development assistance, which is concessional, low-interest, low-cost lending to the government and grants.
Amin says to achieve the program's goals, Sudan must implement it successfully for at least 6 months under the supervision of the IMF. Sudan must also come up with a plan for reducing poverty. In addition, the country must first be removed from the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism before the U.S. can support its entry into the HIPC program. Amin says the reform program addresses the major distortions in Sudan's macroeconomy.
And you need macroeconomic stability in order to get to the next level, which would be to focus on creating jobs and building agriculture, industry, and sort of broad-based economic growth. None of that's possible when there's so many distortions and high inflation and, you know, rapidly declining pound. So this puts us on the path to stability. So that by itself is important.
Sudan's inflation rate stood at 167% in August. Amin says the staff monitored program will have Sudan reduce the amount of money the government spends on subsidizing diesel and gasoline, which he says amounted to close to 40% of Sudan's budget last year.
Last year, in proportion to Sudan's revenues, it was among the largest and the highest in the world. If we don't reduce the amount of money we were spending on subsidies, and here we're only speaking about diesel and gasoline, you know, not wheat or medicine. There are other subsidies that will remain, or cooking fuel. Those things will remain. But in terms of diesel and gasoline, we can't really balance the budget with those big subsidies.
Sudan will also have to reform its state-owned enterprises, ensure the independence of its central bank, and reform the banking sector, said Amin. Earlier this month, Sudan's transitional government announced a state of economic emergency and instituted measures to curb the country's skyrocketing inflation and stop the rapid depreciation of the Sudanese pound against the US dollar. The government enacted laws and put in place a joint force to crack down on illegal traders dealing in gold and hard currency. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington.
Saturday, September 26, is World Contraception Day, a day the UN has set aside to emphasize the importance of sexual and reproductive health and family planning to support providers of that care for women and girls everywhere. However, this year, the challenge to universal access to the contraception and family planning are far greater than usual due to COVID-19 pandemic. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke to Susan Papp, the Managing Director of Policy and Advocacy at Women Deliver, a global NGO dedicated to health and well-being of women and girls around the world.
Just because COVID has happened, people don't stop having sex and they don't stop having babies. But what we are finding is that there's been a disruption in access to sexual and reproductive health and rights services. And this disruption maps very well to what kind of disruption we saw in Africa with Ebola several years ago.
How so?
Supply chains are compromised. Services like access to contraception, wellness visits around family planning, access to safe abortion. And in some places where you have particularly strained health systems in Africa, sexual and reproductive health and rights services fall off because these systems are so strained.
Because of COVID?
Yes.
So what's the upshot of that? How does this falling off affect women?
So the Guttmacher Institute is a think tank. They, along with some UN agencies, have conducted a number of estimates on what it means when sexual and reproductive health and rights services are disrupted. As a result of these disruptions, 50 million more women have an unmet need for contraception. 16 million women are going to have unintended pregnancies. 200 million will experience major obstetric complications, and 1,000 additional maternal deaths are estimated to happen as a result of disruptions in services around reproductive and sexual health. So it's really alarming, the downstream effects of COVID, particularly to girls and women.
What is the remedy you suggest to right this balance?
I would say the UN systems and the governments need to recognize that sexual and reproductive health and rights are an essential part of services, that it's a non-negotiable. The UN General Assembly had several political statements that are going before all of the member states. One is an omnibus statement on COVID, and that omnibus statement rightly understands the gender dimensions of COVID. And so that's a positive sign. The World Health Organization also recognized the gender dimensions of COVID. The UN Secretary General has put out a COVID response and recovery plan that has gender dimensions included. But I think what we really need to ensure is that those aren't just words on a page, that it leads to action. And that action comes down to country leaders recognizing the normative guidance from the UN and following through on it.
President Donald Trump Wednesday said he will not commit to a peaceful transfer of power if he loses the election, and again questioned the legitimacy of an expected increase in mail-in voting due to the coronavirus pandemic. Recent polling indicates that significantly more Democrats plan to vote by mail than Republicans. VOA's Brian Padden reports Trump's comments came as both parties prepare for the likelihood of a bitterly contested presidential election in November.
The partisan divide over mail-in voting could lead to what some pundits are calling a contested red mirage election. Under that scenario, President Trump might claim victory after securing an early lead on election night, but eventually lose to Democratic Party rival Joe Biden as absentee ballots are counted in the days that follow. Calling mail-in voting fraudulent and a scam, Trump predicts there could be legal challenges to the ballot count that would ultimately be decided by the Supreme Court. This is one reason he has cited for nominating a replacement to recently deceased liberal justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg before the election.
I think it's very important. I think this will end up in the Supreme Court. And I think it's very important that we have nine justices.
Analysts note that while there is no evidence of widespread vote-by-mail fraud, as the president has alleged, these mail-in ballots do have a higher rejection rate, mostly because voters fail to fill them out properly. Also, as happened during this year's primary elections in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic, some states experienced long delays in counting the surge of mail-in ballots.
The more you encourage people to vote by mail, the larger the number of people who will be disenfranchised and their votes aren't going to count.
The Supreme Court's role in all of this, if any, remains to be seen.
But hopefully we won't be in a situation in which we're asking justices to rule on a case that will decide the outcome of the election. I think that would be very problematic for democracy.
In the closely contested 2000 presidential election, the Supreme Court ruled on a vote recount dispute in Florida that essentially provided Republican George W. Bush a victory over former Democratic Vice President Al Gore by one electoral vote. Gore then conceded, saying it was for the good of the country, despite winning the overall popular vote. President Trump, when asked Wednesday if he would commit to a peaceful transfer of power if he loses the election, said only we are going to see what happens. With partisan tensions so high, both sides fear a bitterly contested election could spark political clashes between right-wing militias and radical leftists. Brian Patton, VOA News, Washington.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm VOA health correspondent Linor Mudu. The World Health Organization and Africa Centers for Disease Control say we all can help fight the coronavirus pandemic by wearing face masks that cover our mouths and noses when we are in crowded areas. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest news on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
That's our show for this Friday. We now leave you with the song Bambema Kemot by Simon Kero.
Kaimo moya garwa saki Bambe mkaimo moya garwa saki Zaman motoro zede mat turu dumara Zaman matara zede mat turu dumara Bambe mkaimo moya hilo wasaki Bambe mkaimo moya hilo wasaki Wasini dunga mayan me pare Wasini dunga mayan me pare Aparo eme ajiro chini kusende yona kwalio Aspire karanga juba na wawo wada Bambe makaimo moya garwa saki
We have been listening to Simon Kero with the song Bambe Makaimot. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, wear a mask if you must leave your house. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Ya bay guri chugwaje Ya bay guri chugwaje washini dunga mayar me pare washini dunga mayar me pare ndeko kandara kamsa ginia kamuni fungo.